Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Taliban in Kabul's broad daylight. A coordinated attack in the center of Kabul, Afghanistan, with suicide bombers, car bombers, and insurgents with rifles. Civilians on the run, the Afghan government on the ropes, and a setback for the U.S. and NATO on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, January 18th, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. The Takeaway this morning is a bold attack in Afghanistan's capital and the tragedy continuing to unfold in Haiti after last week's earthquake. Joining me is Miles O'Brien this morning and all week for the vacationing Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Miles.
Good to be with you, John. Let's get right to those top stories you're talking about. The streets of Kabul were a battlefield this morning. A group of armed Taliban militants, some wearing suicide bombing vests, tried to storm the presidential palace and other government buildings. They fanned out, taking up positions on rooftops before Afghan troops were able to take some control of the situation hours later.
We spoke to a BBC correspondent earlier this morning, Mark Dummett, who was trapped in one of those hotels there in the center city of Kabul. And I asked him whether he and other international news reporters were targeted in this raid.
The hotel where we are staying is right in the heart of things, as it were. It's in Kabul's small city center, which is home to the presidential palace and government ministries. We know the fighting has spread from one place to the other around us, from a shopping center. We hear of fighting in the Ministry of Finance, and now we understand there's fighting in a cinema, which is on the other side of the hotel.
So this has to be incredibly demoralizing to what there was of a National Guard.
These attacks are becoming more and more coordinated. Of course, this isn't the first attack on Kabul. The city residents have got fairly used to suicide attacks. They do happen every other month or so, but you know, this attack is much bigger in scale, obviously, because it involves more people, suicide attackers and gunmen, and car bombers. So the nature of that threat is obviously a worry, will obviously be a worry to the Afghan government and to the U.S. and NATO forces who are based here.
He's under something of a siege there in Kabul earlier this morning, BBC correspondent Mark Dummett.
Officials say at least five people were killed and nearly 40 wounded. Seven of the attackers were also killed. The situation ongoing. On to Haiti now, where in the past 15 minutes, the European Union pledged nearly $600 million to help those affected by last week's earthquake. Meanwhile, thousands of U.S. troops are expected to arrive off the coast of Haiti's devastated city of Port-au-Prince today to help relief organizations get supplies to survivors. They'll also be reinforcing 1,000 U.S. troops already on the ground. Lieutenant General Ken Keene, Deputy Commander of U.S. Southern Command, says the security condition remains difficult.
We have had incidents of violence that impede our ability to support the government of Haiti.
Some election hits now. The fate of President Obama's health care overhaul could depend on who will fill the Massachusetts Senate seat left vacant by Edward Kennedy's death. Special election on Tuesday. The president was there over the weekend.
Asian markets down. European indices up slightly. Here at home, the markets close for the MLK holiday. Coming up, parents, do you wonder the best way to talk to your kids about scary or tragic events like the Haiti earthquake? Later in the hour, we'll find out how parents can help their kids channel anxieties into positive outcomes as the nation commemorates the life and work of the civil rights leader, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Our God is marching on. Yeah. Glory, hallelujah.
That's
glory.
We're asking our listeners, how far as a nation have we come in realizing Dr. King's dreams? What parts of his vision have we accomplished? But also, how much more work needs to be done? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org.
I think one of the best ways we can honor Dr. King today is to get food and water as soon as possible to the people of Haiti, especially the children.
877-8-MY-TAKE. That's how you reach us. Coming up, more on Haiti. Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Miles O'Brien, who's in for the vacationing Celeste Headlee all week. Good morning, Miles.
Good to be here.
You know, I don't know if you watched or took a look at the coverage from Haiti over the weekend, but each individual story of people reaching out for help, the help not arriving, was, I think, emblematic of a huge story. You can't really even put into context the number 100,000, which is what they're saying the death toll is going
to be. It's very difficult to get a sense of the magnitude of the problem and the tragedy there, I think.
And each one of the stories, it both tells a tiny slice and tells it all. And we've been relying on the remarkable team of reporters we have on the ground in Port-au-Prince from our colleagues at the BBC. Listen to Mark Doyle speaking with, having a conversation which is tragic and sadly typical.
Any medical attention here? Any doctors, any nurses?
Nothing at all. We don't have no aid, no nothing at all. No food, no water, no medical, no doctor, nothing at all. You are the first one who visit us, sir.
Mark Doyle, the first one to visit that community of people waiting for aid. The people in Port-au-Prince and around Haiti in the wake of last week's earthquake are fending for themselves. Jean-Yvan Kernizan, Haitian-American, survivor of the earthquake, what's it like to know that you're on your own?
It's actually very hard, especially in the first hours of the tragedy. We were hoping that the people from the United Nations, the minister, would be of assistance to the people. But up until we left on Thursday night, we had not seen one single soldier even directing traffic.
Well, Jean-Yvan Kernizan is a Haitian-American survivor in our studio who was there during the earthquake, as you just mentioned, arrived back here late last week. Also in the studio with us is Selena Ryan, a survivor, friend of Jean. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So, first of all, Jean, just explain the story that happened to you. I mean, where were you when the earthquake hit, and just how did it unfold over the days before you decided to leave?
We got home a bit late, and we were having a late lunch when it happened. And all of a sudden, it's like the whole table moved, hit the china that was next to it, and it took me a few seconds to realize what was going on. And with the help of the friends that they have a little more experience in earthquake, being from California.
Right.
And we formed a chain. There were five of us, and we formed a chain and to get out because you couldn't do it on your own. It was so, everything was like moving around.
And what happened to your home?
Thank God the home is still standing. We may have to assess the structural damage, but the home is still standing.
But because it was still standing, Selena, it became the obvious location for a makeshift hospital, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly. We soon after it happened, we opened the gate into the courtyard, and people started streaming in from the neighborhood who were injured and needed help. So we did what we could with the small amounts of medical supplies we had, like a bottle of hydrogen peroxide and some bandages and
how many people?
Water. I think within the amount of time, up to 200 people came through at some point.
One bottle of hydrogen peroxide and some...
and a bottle of alcohol. We actually had two bottles. We found another bottle in the house.
Yeah. What emotionally are your colleagues, your compatriots going through in Haiti as you've seen these stories and watched the coverage since you returned?
I think one thing that is very therapeutic for the people, especially the young people, is the fact that they were the one helping. Because you sense that when you are in a lot of pain and you're helping other people that are in pain, your pain kind of diminishes. And this is what happened to us and to a lot of people that were helping. At one point, you didn't matter anymore. It was more like, because we had no gloves, for example, and you know all the risk associated with dealing with blood and not having a gloves on, but it didn't matter. You see, the important thing was to be able to provide a little bit of assistance to the people that were injured.
People in Haiti are used to fending for themselves in this situation, and while that is heroic, it also points up the real abandonment of Haiti on the part of the infrastructure, which really should be there. How does the UN stack up? They took a terrible hit last week, but nevertheless, are they to be relied on here, Selena?
I think in my experience, being in Haiti before the earthquake hit, as we were talking to a lot of people, the sense of the UN presence there is not a positive one, even before this happened. And we were able to see that firsthand, that when the earthquake hit, they were nowhere to be found to give any assistance. And even though they were hit hard, as everyone else was, you know, they're soldiers and they should be expected. They're trained to be in these kinds of situations and need to be of assistance. They're trained for that.
And Selena Ryan talking about the peacekeepers who were nowhere to be found. Of course, again, we mentioned that they took a big hit themselves as a result of the earthquake. But Jean-Yvonne Kernison, what about the police force in Haiti? What about the government?
It was about the same thing. We finally saw them. It was at the first gas station. We were trying to get some gas, and they came, blocked everything, and it's like kicked everybody out and took all that was available.
You're incredibly lucky to be here in the studio. How did you get out? How were you able to get out?
Well, and I like to take a second to thank the people of Fort McGuire, the base there, mm-hmm. Air Force Base at Fort McGuire. They were really, really amazing. I mean, they went out of their way to make us comfortable. We got out. We were on the second plane that left Haiti.
Wow.
And we started early. The thing is, at one point when we had nothing else, no more supplies, we thought that it would be easier if we came and let people know what's going on in order for the people of Haiti to get, for things to be moving bit quicker, because it was so slow. And up until we left on Thursday night, no one had received not even a bottle of water.
Well, basically, based on your experience, and we're going to leave it here, but 12,000 U.S. troops will be on the ground by the end of today. That's a positive thing?
And what I'm hoping is that they are there for the people, not to protect a segment of the population.
Right. Well, you're evoking a complicated history between the U.S. and Haiti. Jean-Yvonne Kernison, Haitian-American survivor of the earthquake last week, along with Selena Ryan, both were in Haiti and returned late last week. And now at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on the headlines we're following.
Afghanistan's President Karzai says order has been restored to the heart of the capital city, Kabul. That's after a deadly gun battle involving Taliban militants. At least 5 people are dead. Back to Haiti now. The U.S. says it's working aggressively to speed up deliveries of aid there. But as this man tells our partner BBC, things on the ground are still catastrophic.
I've seen some dead bodies being burned just in a corner, and it seems to be just casual because people just keep on driving or walking in front of them, and then you see people just sleeping everywhere.
It's horrifying, but there are some glimmers of hope. A UN spokeswoman says more than 1,700 rescue workers have saved over 70 lives since the quake. Late last night, U.S. teams with search dogs rescued a 16-year-old Dominican girl trapped for 5 days in a collapsed hotel. One survivor, Rick Santos, says his group went through a wide range of emotions while buried beneath the Montana Hotel.
Despair and the elation were at different moments. And, you know, I think when it first hit, we were like, okay, we're trapped, but we're alive. And that's something. And so now the question is, how do you stay alive?
Here in the U.S., President Obama was stumping in Boston yesterday for the Democratic candidate, Martha Coakley, who is in a very, very tough race to succeed the late Ted Kennedy. And the Turkish man who shot Pope John Paul II in 1981 was released from prison today. He spent 29 years behind bars. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, the life and work of Martin Luther King Jr.
Hey, you want that to go?
Welcome back to the program. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee on vacation this week. Let's have some takeouts now, shall we? Stories we're following this week. Let's start with Washington, a takeout on Haiti. Here's Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Miles.
You were on a conference call and got a good overview of what the U.S. is attempting to do to help out Haiti. And we're told this morning 12,000 troops on the way. Give us the big picture here on what the U.S. is doing to try to help.
Yeah, the U.S. State Department, USAID, and the military briefing reporters from the U.S. Embassy in Port-au-Prince yesterday, Miles. Just an update on search and rescue. Now, as of yesterday afternoon, the United States said that international search and rescue had pulled 61 people alive from the rubble in Port-au-Prince. Now, we also understood that yesterday an additional 3 people had been pulled from that Caribbean market that collapsed in the middle of town. There's a little bit of confusion around town, of course, as to exactly how many people had been pulled alive. 29 of these people, according to the U.S. government, were Americans. Now, today, Monday, the U.S. makes pains to say that the Haitian government is in the lead here, but the United States, the State Department, and USAID saying that at some time today, the decision will probably be made, the, quote, difficult decision, to move this operation from search and rescue to recovery, meaning starting to assume that no one else is left alive in the rubble and moving this to a recovery operation. Unclear when that will happen, but they say that will happen at some point today.
All right.
Tell us
about the troops, 12,000 troops. What's on the ground there right now? It's so chaotic. All the numbers are hard to keep track of here.
It's chaotic. The numbers are hard to keep track of. Most of those 12,000 are either on the way or on ships. There are not nearly as many American boots on the ground, probably closer to 1,000 or less. Those troops will probably have primarily the responsibility of securing food and water distribution sites. There is still a little bit of confusion, or at least there was as of yesterday, between the Haitian government, the UN, and the United States as to what exactly the role of those troops will be. Reporters were asking the colonel in charge of controlling the airport there, and by the way, the military is controlling the airport, why more U.S. boots aren't on the ground, why they're on ships on the Vincent and other ships in the harbor or off the coast. He said they have had to prioritize food and water coming in on planes versus troops. You got to prioritize those, and there's only so many landings at the airport that are possible, about 60 a day.
Our last takeout marks Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. This weekend, WNYC Radio hosted a celebration for the holiday at the Brooklyn Museum in New York. Our own Celeste Headlee, on vacation this week, co-hosted the event. This morning, we're bringing you some of the prominent civil rights activists she spoke to.
I'm Dr. Roscoe C. Brown Jr., former president of Bronx Community College and a former Tuskegee Airman, and a lifetime advocate for racial justice, fairness, and equality.
So, on this Martin Luther King Day of this year, maybe you could tell us what part of Dr. King's vision has been realized? What do we still have yet to accomplish?
The part about legal segregation has been realized. When people say we're in a post-racial society, I say we're in a post-segregation society, because many of the things that legally were done against black people can't be done now. But there's still a tremendous amount of covert racism in our society.
You come from a generation that maybe many people don't remember or have touch with now, and I'm wondering if you could kind of give us an example of something to help us understand how far we've come since the days of your childhood.
Well, how far we've come, I grew up in Washington, D.C. in a middle-class black neighborhood, but I had to walk past 2 white high schools to go to the famed Dunbar High School, which happened to be better, but it was segregated, and we could not go to the white schools. Similarly, many times when we would travel, we could not stop to eat in a restaurant. They want you to go to the back and take food out from the back. We couldn't ride in certain parts of the train. So that type of legal segregation really has ended. But the kind of covert segregation where people are denied jobs is still there.
That was Dr. Roscoe Brown, a professor at City University of New York, with Celeste Headlee. He is a former Tuskegee Airman.
So our sports takeaway, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, takeaway sports contributor. Against all odds, the Jets beat the Chargers. And I have to figure that this is a morning for that sports fan, that Jets fan, that little kid Jets fan who believed despite all the analysts counting out the Jets.
It's true. And while most of the time we spend a lot of time talking about quarterbacks, Mark Sanchez is not the leader of this team. The leader is another rookie whose name we're going to know now is a guy named Sean Green. It is Sean Green's offense. He has been the running back that has led this Jets rushing attack in the playoffs, and he's unstoppable. A couple other names, Kerry Rhodes and Darrell Revis. Who are those
Revis
guys?
Revis on the defense,
they're
right.
The two top defenders on the Jets in the secondary that went up against the Chargers wide receiver core that was really almost better than the Colts, who they're going to face next week. That's a better wide receiving core than they're going to face next week. So I would argue that the Jets face one of the best wide receiving cores in the league, and they stopped them.
And in this particular game, and really the last 2 games, the Jets have been able to establish their running game which means they are a threat on the ground,
correct,
which intimidates the defense. That's going to be a storyline for the game against the Colts next week.
It's
right?
True. What they were able to do, there was one touchdown where they ran the ball, and then they bootleg, which means that the quarterback faked the run, and then he pulled out, he rolled to the right, and then he threw a pass. That is the basic formula for winning football. With the Indianapolis Colts, they have a porous running defense, and the Jets will be able to exploit that.
Well, the Jets beat the Chargers 17-14. Other scores, Minnesota over Dallas in a humiliation 34-3. Saints beat the Cardinals 45-14, another humiliation, and the Colts beat the Ravens 20-3. So, you know, you called this Jets game win. This is the one long shot. Everything else was a blowout this weekend. But you called this Jets game. Am I not correct?
You're correct, but I think it's hilarious that I called it. However, if the Chargers hadn't missed three field goals in this game,
yeah, that's true.
If they hadn't missed two, then they would have won the game.
So I got to figure you're that kid, sports fan, that this day is made for. Who everyone else counted out the Jets, but you're wandering around with a smile on your face saying, I believe.
J-E-T-S, Jets.
Disclosing his bias and the fact that he'll have to recuse himself.
But
the
I am a Giants
NFL
fan.
Season.
I am a
Ibrahim
Giants fan.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports.
Good morning.
Coming up, the agenda. Coming up, a look at this week's agenda, and center stage in the agenda for President Obama is that special election for the Senate seat in Massachusetts. We're going to talk about everything the Obama administration faces this week. But first, let's check in on top stories at 30 minutes after the hour. You're listening right now to sound of gunfire echoing in the streets of Kabul this morning after a group of armed Taliban militants tried to storm the presidential palace and other government buildings. U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan Richard Holbrooke said the Taliban will not win no matter how many attacks it launches.
It's not surprising that the Taliban do this sort of thing. They're desperate people. They're ruthless. The people who are doing this certainly will not survive the attack, nor will they succeed. But we can expect this sort of thing on a regular basis. That is who the Taliban are.
Five people were killed, at least 40 wounded. Seven of the attackers were also killed. On to Haiti, where the heartbreak continues to permeate Port-au-Prince.
I don't have house. I don't have anything. I don't have food. I don't have water to drink.
And Kenneth Merton, the U.S. ambassador to Haiti, tells NBC News he has no idea how much it's going to cost to rebuild Haiti.
It's an incredible situation. Downtown Port-au-Prince looks, as I imagine Tokyo looked after the Second World War. It is flattened.
The European Union this morning pledged nearly $600 million to the relief effort.
The five Americans being held in Pakistan on suspicion of terrorism had this to say as they were being driven from court today. Police and prison authorities are denying any mistreatment, however. The five Americans were detained in December after being accused of plotting terror attacks in Pakistan and having links to Al-Qaeda. At the Golden Globes last night, Avatar won Best Film
big
Drama.
Surprise.
Yeah,
big surprise.
Well, actually, yeah, it did surprise some people. James Cameron took home Best Director. I guess if the film wins, he gets that, right?
right.
And Meryl Streep with her, what was it, seventh?
Seventh Golden Globe.
Playing Julia Child in Julia and Julia. Robert Downey Jr. winning for Sherlock Holmes. As for the markets, Asian markets down, European indices up, and the U.S. markets are off today for the MLK holiday. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
So the headlines go right into the agenda this morning. Rob Watson, political correspondent for the BBC in London, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partners, the New York Times. They joined us earlier this morning, and right off the top, I asked Rob about the implications of this Afghanistan attack.
Well, I think it's obviously a worrying development. This looks like, although it's still early stages, one of the most sophisticated attacks that the Taliban have mounted yet in the Afghan capital. And one thing that I did after the attack started was to just look up the figures as to the deteriorating security. And I went to dig up the GAO, the good old reliable government accountability office. You've got to go with their stats. And just to note this, from January to August of 2009, there were 13,000 attacks on civilians, coalition forces and Afghan forces. That was 2.5 times greater than the same period 2008. and obviously a lot up, five times up on 2,500 attacks in 2005. So I think you can see this as really part of a very worrying deterioration in the security.
Well, whether it will be viewed as a kind of Vietnam Tet offensive in its boldness and brazenness as far as the Obama administration and NATO is concerned, we will have to see. Marcus Mabry, here in the United States, there is a very, very tense standoff, a contest in Massachusetts that the entire Obama agenda may hinge on. Explain.
Martha Coakley, the Democratic nominee to take over Ted Kennedy's venerated seat, the Democrats have venerated, and even some Republicans have venerated it in the United States Senate, is up against Scott Brown, the Republican state senator, and right now in some polls he's leading her.
And here is the president speaking at a campaign rally on Sunday.
If you were fired up in the last election, I need you more fired up in this election. I need you out there working just as hard right now in those final days.
I don't know, Marcus Mabry. He sounds all in.
Oh,
there in
he's all in, and he's scared to death.
And it took them by surprise that this was going to be a cliffhanger. Yes,
and it shouldn't have, because although we all think of Massachusetts as the People's Republic of Massachusetts, a very left-leaning blue state, the bluest of blue. The fact is, although Democrats outnumber Republicans 3-1 in that state, they're actually the majority of the people in Massachusetts are actually unaffiliated. They don't believe in either party, so it's a much more independent state,
a little bit more like New Hampshire,
exactly, than we suspect. However, none of that will matter. None of that reality will matter if the Democrats lose this seat. Healthcare will be imperiled, and Obama will have to readjust his entire agenda.
And the Republicans are already positioning themselves. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says we've already won.
Regardless of the outcome Tuesday, we know that in the most liberal state in America, you're going to have a close election for the United States Senate because people in Massachusetts don't want this healthcare bill to pass.
All right. Is he right?
No, he's not right, because it's about a lot more than that. You wouldn't expect him to say anything else. And the fact is, if the Republicans don't win the seat, and they don't win the seat, it will make a huge difference. The Democrats will still have their supermajority of 60 and will still run through with their health care plan.
How much is the international agenda of the Obama presidency on the line with the relief effort in Haiti now taking center stage? Marcus Mabry, and then I want to check with Rob Watson.
Well, again, I think politically the Republicans have tried to make this Obama's New Orleans. The fact is, it's not New Orleans. It's not an American city. I was in Haiti last 15 years ago with American soldiers who were coming in at that point to restore Jean-Baptiste Aristide to power. Haiti is the great shame of the Western Hemisphere. It has been before. It will remain after. I think the question right now is one of personal relief, one of humanity and humanitarian relief, and that's what the administration has to rise up to. It's not really a political thing. I don't think it's going to affect the larger international agenda, but it will affect their image as caring in a different American leadership.
Rob Watson, do you think there's a clock ticking on the international community coming to the aid of Haiti, or will this sort of pass?
Well, I think there's a clock ticking in terms of the immediate requirements.
Indeed.
And clearly, they're pretty intense, and the international community is struggling. I don't think it's necessarily fair to criticize the international community when you think that the actual port in Port-au-Prince has gone, that the roads aren't great. The roads that there are absolutely clogged with traffic. So it's no easy matter. I guess there's another question, which Marcus kind of alluded to, which is, to what extent will interest continue in Haiti once the immediate danger has passed and the immediate crisis over?
Well, let's talk about Pakistan. Those five U.S. Muslim men are charged with plotting terror attacks in Pakistan. They are U.S. passport holders. It looks like they're going to be seeking life sentences. Where does this case stand in terms of U.S. concerns about terrorism and especially recruiting taking place in the United States, Rob Watson?
Well, I'm not completely familiar with all of the details of this particular case, although I do know of it. I would say this, really, and that is that U.S. concerns are not at the level that they are in the United Kingdom. It's a really good way, it's a good comparison, because in the United Kingdom, here in Britain, pretty much every single major attack has been linked to people of British citizens of Pakistani descent who then made the link back to Pakistan to al-Qaeda recruiters there. There's a very, very clear pattern. We have hundreds of thousands of British citizens of Pakistani descent who go back to Pakistan for annual visits. So it's a huge problem here. There just hasn't been that scale of problem in the United States. And, I certainly have my own theories about that the United States is a country of immigrants, that if you look at the Pakistani community in the United States, its median income is higher than the average white family. So it's just not the same circumstances. But is it something that's probably ringing the odd alarm bell? Well, you betcha.
All right, Rob Watson, political correspondent for the BBC in London, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our other partners, the New York Times. They both joined us early this morning for this week's agenda. As the nation commemorates the life and work of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
Well, he certainly proved it by the way that he lived and his legacy. We're asking you this morning, what more does America need to do in order to fulfill Dr. King's dreams? You can tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. And coming up, parents ever wonder how to best explain scary or tragic events like the Haiti earthquake to young children? We're going to talk about it. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee on vacation this week. It's W-2 time at work. Sorry to tell you that.
Thanks for reminding me there, Miles. We like having you come in.
The cruel reminder. They brought me in for that. The tax season is upon us, so this is a good day to talk about an IRS victory. Why don't we do that? We'll begin on a high note for the tax season. Lori Singleton Clark is a nurse in Maryland. The IRS sued her after she deducted her tuition for an MBA degree. But guess what? Lori won. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, great. And you are obviously doing well. Congratulations. This goes back to 2005, your tax return. You're a nurse. You tried to deduct $15,000 for tuition expenses for an MBA. And on the face of it, I might say, well, wait a minute. You're a nurse. How can you deduct an MBA tuition? How did that work out for you?
Well, actually, that's what the IRS felt as well. I went.
So wait a minute. So you're telling me I think like the IRS? Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Anyway, go ahead.
We don't like to tell them.
Yeah. I went back to school to get an MBA because I wanted to be on the same level with physicians in terms of explaining regulatory and accrediting matters. And my degree is a dual degree. It's an MBA in healthcare management. When the IRS saw that I was taking accounting courses, finance courses, and economic courses, they said, wait a minute, she's studying for a different career field.
Hmm.
So my challenge was to explain to the IRS, no, I'm not. I'm actually going to use this information, these courses, to improve my performance at work.
So what that implies is the IRS is, like me, a little bit clueless about what nurses do, huh?
Exactly. Nurses today have expanded roles. And we're in management, we're at the bedside, we're out, you know, handling disasters, et cetera. And my function at that time was to explain to doctors how important their documentation is in making sure that the care they're providing to their patients is appropriate, is timely, and meets regulatory and accrediting bodies.
Lori, it sounds like you should add lawyer to that, too. I mean, you did this on your own, and you got this MBA degree online, right?
Exactly. And I've gone, my undergraduate degree, I did go to school, you know, physically stay in school, but the master's degree was online, and it was appropriate for me where I was in my, you know, in my life, raising children, working full time. I just physically could not go to a school and sit in a classroom. So
you're amazing that you pulled all this off, and you beat the odds, right? What is it? What, 10% win?
That's what I'm told. I couldn't believe it. It was a personal endeavor. I had no idea that my victory would gain so much attention. But the responses I've gotten have been very positive.
All right, Lori, excellent. Congratulations. Lori Singleton Clark, we'll remember you April 15th.
She's a registered nurse in Maryland. As the nation commemorates the life and work of civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
We're asking you, what more does America need to do in order to fulfill Dr. King's dreams? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. John Hockenberry here, not with Celeste Headlee, but with Miles O'Brien, which is pretty huge, but even huger than that. Coming up, we've got Danny Glover, who's going to be here, and Corey Smith. They collaborated on a movie called Soundtrack of a Revolution. the songs of the Civil Rights Movement.
You're going to like that one.
Yes, indeed. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Taliban gunmen and suicide bombers have attacked the heart of the Afghan capital, Kabul, in what appears to be a very coordinated attack. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, was swearing in members of his new cabinet when the attack began. For the latest, we go now to the BBC's Mark Dummett in Kabul. Mark, we spoke to you earlier this morning. Has there been an all-clear from the government, as far as you know?
Well, President Karzai has said that, as far as he's aware, yes, the situation is now under control. And certainly, from where I'm speaking from, which is right in the center of Kabul, close to the buildings which came under attack, I mean, it is very quiet now, and it has been quiet for the past 3 hours, 2 or 3 hours. But still, you know, the city hasn't exactly returned to normal. Many people, I imagine, are too afraid to go out into the streets. And certainly around here, there is a large presence of Afghan soldiers and military.
In the middle of the attack, Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, said all this proves is that the Taliban won't win. Do you think there's another message to the people of Kabul in this attack from the Taliban?
Well, sure. I mean, I think the Taliban's message is pretty clear, which is that they can strike right in the heart of the capital. Now, the area which they attacked is home to President Karzai's palace, many government ministries, as well as the main shopping area. There's a very, very big security presence here. There are checkpoints. There are lots of armed guards, security personnel keeping an eye on this part of the town. So they were able to say, look, we can attack even this part, the most secure part of the capital city. On the other hand, they weren't able to successfully attack the presidential palace or the ministries. In the end, they only inflicted damage on pretty soft targets, a cinema, a movie hall, and two shopping malls.
All right, and they used some number of suicide bombers and as many as 20 Taliban soldiers, it's believed. Mark Dummett, BBC correspondent, thanks for that.
To Haiti now, and more U.S. Marines will be joining the relief effort today. Also, former President Bill Clinton, the U.N. Special Envoy for Haiti, is expected to visit the country. Despite the security challenges on the ground, Kenneth Merton, the U.S. Ambassador to Haiti, told NBC News this morning that things are looking up.
The Haitian police, due to their own significant losses, are degraded. You have a U.N. force which has had its own losses, so they're not able to perform at the level they, you know, that they probably would like. However, given that, I think things are going reasonably well.
Here in the U.S., the race to succeed Ted Kennedy is down to the wire in Massachusetts. Democrats and Republicans have flooded the state to boost the turnout of voters in their favor. Yesterday, President Obama was in Boston stumping for Democratic candidate Martha Coakley.
I need you knocking on doors. I need you making phone calls. I need you talking to your friends and your neighbors and telling them what's at stake on Tuesday, that every vote matters, that every voice matters.
Those are some of the stories we're following for you this morning.
Roll out of the shadows and find that eventually. There we are, where we are, and what we are is still family.
You know, it's hard enough watching those images of Haiti, but throw kids into the picture, and they inevitably see this. Yeah, what do you tell your kids? You have younger kids.
Well, I have two 11-year-olds, two 8-year-olds, and an infant who's not paying much attention. But I tell you, my kids, what they focus on is the idea that you could be going on in your life, and then, boom, something happens and your house falls on you. That's the thing that's so tough for them.
Yeah, so it's tough. How much do you sugarcoat it? Yolanda Gault-Cavaness, our family contributor, has done some research on this topic. She's here to share some tips with us. And also joining us, David DeRozier, a 17-year-old volunteer with a Haitian charity, Third World Uprising. He'll explain how getting involved has helped him cope with what's going on. But Yolanda, let's begin with you. It's finding the line between too much information and being, you know, just a little too saccharine, because kids can read right through that.
Oh, they've got huge BS detectors. So my advice is don't sugarcoat it at all, because they will see right through it. It's very tough as a parent. You know, you mentioned the images. They're startling to us. And so you feel like as a mom, as a dad, you're supposed to protect them, but this is a tough road. You can't really protect them from what goes on in the world. So my first thing is, you know your kid better than the expert. Figure out where they are emotionally and meet them right there. If they're talking about the devastation, say, you know what? Yeah, it is. It's awful. It's
You know, you bring up an interesting point. If they're talking about the devastation, if they're not talking, you still should probably bring it up because a kid won't bring it up, right?
Older kids, it's hard. I mean, yeah. My kids are about the same age, actually. It's funny. 11, 9, and then a 2-year-old. And the 11-year-old won't say much. She will kind of, I think she's internalizing it. She's not going to blurt out like the other one will. Oh, my God, Mommy, what will do? And you have to coax it out of them. And sometimes I think what I try to do is I say, you know, empathize. I'm like you. Sometimes when things are really rough, I kind of shut down too. Are you feeling this? Are you feeling that? Because you want to try to get them to talk about it. They need to get it out.
And different ages, you pass through. I remember when my kids were 5, death and sudden death was really a huge issue.
Yeah.
Then they get a little older. They pass out. My 11-year-olds are much more interested in the help idea.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see how the help idea. Yeah, because I think this is a great notion. I'll tell you what, let's bring in David DeRosiers now, who is one of those kids who has is found this empowering. He's working with a Haitian charity called Third World Uprising. David, good to have you with us this morning.
Good to be here.
All right, tell us a little bit. Why did you chip in, and how is this helping you out?
Well, basically, I can't say it's helping me out at all. I'm a Haitian myself, and I feel that our Haitian community, we're all Americans here. There are humans out there. All people understand that everybody's a human. People have been explaining to me that, I'm too young for this, I'm too young for that. You must understand, there's people younger than me that's out there getting killed. I have a niece and a nephew. They're 5 and 8. They're out there. My house actually in Haiti is not completely broken down, but everybody's at the church. It's just a very, it traumatized me hearing all this. When my house got the call, they was explaining to us how it was happening. They actually called during the time it was happening. It was like, they explained.
David, you're 17. I have a 17-year-old son as well. What can you do from here to help out?
Well, basically, my first move was contacting my school. My second move was contacting my community centers. My third move was just contacting everybody else who was older than me, because me, I'm just exactly like you said, I'm just 17. If you could get somebody older that can help you, it'll definitely make people see it as a bigger idea. Once you have older people behind you, more people will come behind you.
Thank you, Yolanda. That's a key point, isn't it? That's empowering.
I have to commend him for what he's doing.
Give him credit for that.
Exactly. It's unreal. And you know what, though? I mean, I know that his devastation, it's not focused on what he's doing, but that is healing in some way. You take some actionable step to do something. And you can encourage your kids no matter how old they are. He says he's only 17, which is amazing. But even a 2 or 3-year-old can go online with you and can go onto the Red Cross site or can go on to, Architecture for Humanity and donate and see what they can do, can help raise, the Brownies can help raise money with clothing drives.
Kids
and such
are little problem solvers. They love to
they
see
love
the problem
that.
And see the
they
solution.
Love that. Yeah. It makes them feel so good. And lean on your faith and just keep talking to them and keep reassuring them. Hugs, extra kisses, spending time with them, that kind of stuff is really what's going to go the long way.
David, I'm curious, you talk about how you've sort of leaned on adults to help you out. What about your peers, fellow teens? What are they doing?
Well, basically, they hear what I'm doing, and they ask, how can they get involved, David? What can I do, et cetera, et cetera. I tell them, if you can donate clothes, money, et cetera, I'm going to Haiti myself, so I'm going directly to Haiti, so I'm going from Dominican Republic to Haiti. Therefore, whatever I can bring with me, I will bring with me, and I will help the Haitian people.
When are you going?
I'm supposed to be going this Sunday or the Sunday after that.
All right, we wish you well down there. Please be safe and keep up the good work. David DeRosiers and Yolanda Galt-Cabanes, thank you very much.
Today, the country remembers Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the Haitian crisis sort of puts it into focus.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Dr. King's famous and sadly final speech in honor, we're asking you, has America made it to the promised land?
If Martin Luther King were alive today, I think he would be 100% pro-life, and he'd work for the civil rights of the unborn.
What's your take? Tell us at 877-8-MIND-TAKE or leave a comment on our website at takeaway.org. Our podcast is always on. You can subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Miles O'Brien.
This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.